Hello and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons and this week I mix it with the Oscar nominees. We talk to Cate Blanchett about working with Dame Judi Dench in Notes on a Scandal. I meet Jaimon Hounsou to discuss Africa, Diamonds and Leonardo DiCaprio. And satirising the whole awards season is Christopher Guest, whose new ensemble comedy, for your consideration, also includes Ricky Gervais. I review every film released, and I've got a sumptuously expensive competition for you. All to come on The Observer's top-ranking film podcast, Film Weekly, with me, Jason Solomons. We start with Blood Diamond, which this week earned its leading actors Oscar nominations, as Leonardo DiCaprio got the nod in the Best Actor category, and Jaimon Hounsou entered the race for Supporting Actor. I have to say that both are superb in an adventurous tale directed by Edward Zwick, telling the story of Leo's mercenary diamond smuggler who gets the scent of a huge stone that poor enslaved fisherman Hounsou has hidden in a mine in the north of the country after being captured by rebels. Separated from his family by a coup, Hounsou has to team up with greedy DiCaprio, who promises to help find his family in return for being led to the diamond.
So, which one are you? Smuggler?
Am I?
Somehow you don't strike me as the UNICEF type.
How about soldier of fortune? Or is that too much of a cliche?
Diamonds?
If I told you I was a missionary.
For Van de Kapp?
Better watch that type of talk, Miss Bowen. You know, in America it's bling bling, but out here it's bling bang, huh? I wouldn't want you getting in any trouble.
How much trouble do you think I would get into for talking about blood diamonds?
You're a journalist.
That's right.
Piss off, huh?
Director Zwick weaves an unlikely friendship into the heart of a thrilling action film that also doubles as a political campaign and humanitarian lesson. It's like a diamond with many facets, though not all of them sparkle with the same clarity. DiCaprio is excellent for what I think is the first time since What's Eating Gilbert Grape, mastering the Rhodesian accent, looking cool in the action scenes and conveying the arrogance, desperation and selfishness of his character with great screen charisma. It's the first time I've been convinced he's playing the right age, and it makes his flirtation with Jennifer Connelly's news reporter believable, rather than all those preposterous love interests such as Cameron Diaz in Gangs of New York or Cate Blanchett in The Aviator. Hounsou is also incredibly magnetic here, building on the man-mountain role of Amistad and creating an African man who becomes the symbol of a continent. It's a role that could have been mawkish and glib, but Hounsou invests it with great dignity. In the Rachel Weisz role of earnest campaigner with dark hair and vest top, Jennifer Connelly also manages to put some life into what could have been a preachy script, because Blood Diamond, of all the recent films about Africa, is the most ponderous politically. It lacks the romantic finesse of The Constant Gardener and the passions of The Last King of Scotland and Hotel Rwanda. That said, this is a Hollywood blockbuster that deals with big issues and should be admired for that. Child soldiers, military coups, diamond trade, slave trade, apartheid, refugees, all of this is crammed in like a jungle explorer's overstuffed trunk. Well, fresh from his Oscar nomination last week, I had the pleasure of discussing his representation of Africa with Jaimon Hounsou. You've just got an Oscar nomination. Let's start at the beginning. You've just got an Oscar nomination.
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
It was a fantastic performance, I thought, all the way through. You've been through this Oscar process before, though, so you look a bit wiser than I. You're less excited than I am.
Well, you know, once you go through it, you know, certainly the second time around, it's always the approach is certainly, you know, hopefully better.
What did you think when Salma read your name out?
Oh, I mean, first of all, she got my first name sort of like twisted, and how was it? But I only recognized it when my photo popped up.
Yeah. That's me.
Yeah.
I honestly think it's wonderful for the film to be recognized like that, with both you and Leo recognized.
Absolutely. I mean, that's even more exciting. I mean, for both of us, I mean, from the same film, the best actor and best supporting, that's brilliant.
Because you're a great double act in the movie. I do think he's fantastic in it too. Well, what was it like kind of batting off him? Had you worked with him before? What were your feelings when you knew you were going to be acting opposite Leo?
Well, I've certainly had a certain respect for his work, his ability to do the job, and he's always been quite, you know, respectful of me as well, and run into each other, you know, during award seasons and all that. And, you know, again, you know, you meet some actors and you hope that hopefully, you know, your path will cross and that you would, you know, hopefully do something. But no one could have dreamed of, you know, making this film, you know, for me to be part of Blood Diamond and certainly to have him be my lead actor. And it was a blessing. And I couldn't expect any better person. I mean, with his personality, his demeanor, and the way he, his awareness of the work and the way he comes on set on a daily basis without any, you know, too much drama. It was extremely commendable, you know.
Well, I thought the two of you played really a beautiful kind of buddy relationship going on, but it takes so long. There's such a complex relationship between the two of you.
Very complex.
In a way, I thought that the relationship between you and Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie mirrors the relationships that the Western world or the white world has with Africa. In a way, is that something that had occurred to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, I mean, I've lived in Africa and, you know, born in Africa, left at a very, very young age, but I still have, you know, it is still my makeup, you know, so I see that all the time.
It's an amazing year for African-American actors and Africa at the Oscars. Forest Whitaker, yourself, Eddie Murphy, Will Smith, all in the acting categories. Yeah. Considering that you were only the second male African ever to be nominated at the Oscars, things are changing in Hollywood and Africa is becoming a very hot topic.
True. But again, you know, I mean, I guess it's the time that has decided to go this way, because you have to understand that a lot of those stories were around Hollywood and been in Hollywood for some time. And anytime you get, you know, the studio gets rid of an executive, it's always some of those projects, you know, takes the back seat.
Well, I'm really pleased that you come on Film Weekly. It's really nice to meet you. Jaimon Hansu, what a great pleasure. Congratulations on an Oscar nomination. If you get it on that night, I will be cheering.
Okay, Solomon.
Nice one, Solly.
All right.
That's Emmanuel Jal with Abdel Gadir Salim, the track called Bai from the soundtrack of Blood Diamond. Peter O'Toole received his 7th Oscar nomination for his role in Venus, in which he plays an ageing actor now specialising in corpses. He hangs out with his friends Leslie Phillips and Richard Griffiths in a North London cafe and wakes himself up with a slap in the face. His life is given a fillip when Philip's young niece comes to stay, and taking her out to the royal court gives O'Toole a final lease of life and lust. A glimpse of young, firm flesh is enough to turn O'Toole's silver head, making him to a lovesick fool and a lecherous Lothario.
What are you doing? In London, I mean.
Looking for work.
What sort of work?
Work. You know, work.
Yes, I know all about it. Any particular kind?
Muffling.
Well, there can't be much call for that.
Call for what?
Yodeling.
Not yodeling. Yodeling. Modeling. You know.
Director Roger Michell reteams with scriptwriter Hanif Qureshi for Venus, which could be seen as a companion piece to their last collaboration, The Mother, in which Daniel Craig's taciturn builder rogered Anne Reed over a workbench. But Venus lacks that film's heart. It masquerades as a comedy, or as an essay on growing old disgracefully, but it never quite gets its tone right. You don't expect charm from Qureshi, but he and Michelle seem to be going for it here, and they fall short. O'Toole is good, of course, and one wishes him the best of roistering fun at the Oscars, but the sight of him slobbering over female flesh like some leathery tortoise nosing a carrot is really most unappealing. Newcomer Jodie Whittaker, as the niece, is ostensibly okay, but never really brings a depth of confusion to the role, and there are several moments in quite a short film when I was unconvinced of character motivation, which leads to lots of wandering around London locations as if looking for Woody Allen or Richard Curtis. Also, the soundtrack from Corinne Bailey-Ray is too prominent and too middle of the road for a film which tries to push the envelope about ageing, loneliness and sex. The soundtrack is tacked on like a marketing ploy. Which characters in the film, I ask, are listening to it? Certainly not O'Toole and certainly not young Jodie. So, why is it there? A far better choice of soundtrack comes in Old Joy, which uses the drifty tunes of Yo La Tengo to illustrate a blissful road trip of a movie. Two old friends rekindle the spark of their youth with a drive to some hot springs. Will Oldham, currently touring the UK as folky music act Bonnie Prince Billy, is a jobless stoner who persuades his more bourgeois pal, Daniel London, to take him on a camping expedition. They drive, they chat about old record stores, Will puffs weed and waxes stonedly lyrical. Trees, cars, houses and sky drift on by. London's dog Lucy lolls out of the window. It's like being in the car yourself.
I've still got crates of records in the garage at Ankeny Street, stuff I haven't even listened to in 10 years. I'm going to have to take the whole load down to Sid's, I think, and see what I can get for it.
Sid's is gone, man.
No way.
The rent got to be too heavy. Now it's a smoothie place. Rejuvenation.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Sid sells on eBay now.
Oh, that makes sense. I should be doing that. No more Sids. End of an era.
Not much happens in Old Joy. The friends chat and gradually we see there's a rift between them. Not a very palpable one, but one that's grown through the passing of time and the travelling of different roads. The closeness of youth has dissipated like clouds, and almost imperceptibly director Kelly Reichardt and her actors build tensions and arguments through sweetly comic looks and gestures. The final scenes, when the friends get to their destination, have a wonderful quiet to them, an unhurried majesty that conveys so much. This is, in a sense, an indie Brokeback Mountain, played out in a minor key. I smiled throughout, cried a little, and came out thoroughly refreshed. Daniel, Old Joy, I saw it for the first time this week. It charmed the socks off me, which is a bit terrible in this cold weather to have your socks off, but I'm afraid they are totally charmed off. I thought it was a really delicious piece of cinema. Your role in it is quite interesting because it seems to me there's you and Will. You're almost the straight man in this movie. Is that a role that you kind of fancied playing?
I did like playing this role. I mean, to me, the character I play is, I don't want to think of him as like a jerk, but I know he's a complicated guy, and I sort of, you know, I enjoyed the opportunity to kind of play a role that I was able to kind of figure out as I went. I mean, the way this movie was made, it was a rare experience, at least for me, in that, you know, things were open, and I think it was very important to Kelly Reichardt, the director, that themes of the movie or issues in the movie weren't necessarily pinned down, which allowed us as actors to really kind of be in the moment, which is the best place to be.
For an actor, it certainly is. The movie it requires a lot of driving around from the two of you. Now, normally when actors kind of do the driving, they stick them on a low loader, but surely in this film you were actually driving.
I was driving. We didn't have any frills on this film. Not only was I driving, but a lot of the times they would have to get rid of the rearview mirror because it would be in the way of the camera, so I was kind of driving blind.
At least you weren't driving as stoned as Will. That would have been not so clever. Well, maybe it would have been fun.
That would have been not so good, yeah.
Yeah, but what? Yeah, I mean, what I loved part of it is the Yo La Tengo music on the soundtrack that you drift on with, and the clouds pass and the music goes on. What did you actually have on in the car stereo when you were doing to kind of get you in the mood? Did you have that soundtrack playing?
That soundtrack hadn't been written yet, so no, we didn't have that. It varied. You know, Will was sort of the DJ of the car. I was busy driving, and he would kind of put on whatever he would put on. A lot of the time, it would be a country music radio, and he would be singing along, and I would kind of chime in every now and again. But no, we didn't have that beautiful Yo La Tengo score, which seems so organic to the movie, it's almost, like, surprising that it didn't exist while we were shooting.
See, I love a driving movie. I think they're different from road movies, which are about kind of getting places. This is a real driving movie. It's the act of actually sitting in a car, putting on the indicators, playing with the radio, looking in the mirrors, and like opening the door. There's lots of sounds of car. And so it's almost about the kind of act of driving. I wonder, how do you film so intimately? Was it just you, Will, the dog, and a cameraman?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we had a crew of five people working on this movie. I mean, that was it. And in the car, yeah, it generally was just us and the camera. And sometimes Kelly, the director, would be, you know, ducked down in the back seat. And a lot of times, you know, they're driving next to us, or we're driving by them, and they're outside the car. But I mean, the whole process of making the film was incredibly intimate, and you know, it felt like kind of a group of friends just coming together to get something done, more than like a film shoot, or like any film shoot I'd ever been on before.
Daniel London, really enjoyed the film. Wish you the best of luck with its release in London. Thank you so much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate talking to you.
Daniel London there, one of the stars of Kelly Reichardt's Old Joy. Well, when the Oscar nominees talk, they talk to Film Weekly. We've had Jaimon Hounsou already, but now get ready for one of the great film actresses. Nominated for Best Supporting Actress, Cate Blanchett is, as usual, terrific in next week's release, Notes on a Scandal. Playing Sheba, the bohemian art teacher who embarks on a foolish affair with a pupil, Blanchett faces the wrath of Judi Dench's Barbara, an old schoolmaid who comes to share Sheba's secret but holds it like a ransom note.
Please, I'm begging you, please let me have this Christmas with my family.
Oh, you poor thing. You got yourself into a state. I'm not going to report you. I want to help you, to support you through this.
You're not going to tell. You won't tell anyone.
Who would it benefit? Not you, or the boy, and certainly not the school. No, this is a private matter. And we must keep it so.
I met up with Cate and asked her if she was just getting ready to sashay down another red carpet.
The best thing is to not think about the red carpets at all. But, I mean, it's great for Notes on a Scandal, because given the salacious nature of the subject matter, I mean, I'm so pleased that the kind of the core of the film people have gone to, which is actually about the relationship between the two women.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because I loved the original book, the Zoe Heller novel, when I read it, I thought, well, Sheba's a fantastic role for someone, but it didn't, no offence, but you didn't actually immediately spring to mind.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so how did it come about that you were you offered the part, or was it something you fought for?
No, I'm not very good at fighting for things. I tend to sort of, I don't know, I'm quite fatalistic about work. But I'd read the book and know Patrick Marber, who did the screenplay, and loved the book. But, I mean, often a great book doesn't really translate to the screen. And what Patrick's been able to do is liberate Sheba from Barbara's perspective, because it's, you know, it's diarised from Barbara's perspective in the book. And when Patrick told me he was writing the screenplay, I said, oh, I'd love to read that. And then it all sort of happened quite quickly and effortlessly.
Yes, I mean, it is a wonderful role, and obviously you're opposite Judi Dench, who's also fantastic. And I was kind of reminded, because it's such a kind of tight two-hander, in a way, the best scenes in the film. It kind of reminded me of, like, watching Borg and McEnroe. You know, you were bringing the best out of each other. Did you sort of raise your game, because, you know, Judy was clearly firing on all cylinders?
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. And I think in another actress's hands, Barbara Covert could have been quite a sort of a demonic or vampiric creation, but Judy's got such a deep vein of humanity, and so she allows you to feel for Barbara, even though what she does is sort of reprehensible. You know that it's motivated by this desperate and tragic loneliness.
And can you still learn? I mean, you're pretty.
Can
good.
I still learn?
You're pretty good at this by
every,
now.
Every day.
Yeah, you're still learning from someone like Judi Dench.
Yeah, she's got such an incredible economy as an actress, and her technique is so. I mean, it's a rock, but it's completely buried. And so what she does looks completely effortless. Effortlessness. I can't speak.
She has that listlessness. What about off screen? Because she's quite cheeky.
She's incredibly cheeky. And she and Patrick had a book running, so they were constantly betting on the Gigi's. No, she's great.
She didn't bring you into her web of gambling.
No, I must admit, I'd like to watch other people gamble, but
it's kind of strange because in the book you read it and you think, well, your character's having an affair with a 14-year-old boy, 15-year-old boy.
He's 15. The actor wasn't, thank goodness, but the character is.
So you read about this woman and you think about it, but then actually when it is made concrete on the screen, were you worried that, you know, a grown woman such as yourself sleeping with a young boy, to actually kind of see it is rather different to reading it?
Yeah, the casting process was quite interesting because it really is the subplot of the film, the Sheba's relationship with her student. It's the catalyst that propels her into Barbara's arms, and that's actually the core of the drama. It was important to find a balance between the boy being completely underage and, being shocked, as you say, by the actual visual of that, but then also not casting a boy that was that moved the film into sort of a portrayal of and into the mind of someone who's embarks on pedophilia, you know, which is ultimately what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in a way, yeah.
So it was an interesting process to find Andrew.
Mm. Now, I, this is about teaching, and I don't know if you'd have made a good teacher. Do you fancy ever doing that role?
Look, it crosses every single actor's mind when they leave drama school that one day you will teach. I had some amazing teachers when I was at school, and I think the best teachers are not frustrated actors. But I taught acting when I was at drama school.
Oh, right. Because you're back in Sydney now, aren't you? Working there.
Yes.
At your kind of alma mater where you learned.
Well, the first the place where my husband and I first got our jobs at the Sydney Theatre Company, we've just been appointed the incoming artistic directors, which is really exciting.
You're back into the theatre.
Yeah, well, you never quite leave, do you? And then the set of Notes of a Scandal is evidence of that. I think there's a real exchange between film and theatre, and there can, I think from the media's perspective, there can be sort of a demarcation that one does either one or the other, but they feed into one another. I think the intimacy you get on film actually feeds into your performances on stage and vice versa. I mean, I think all of us, you know, Bill and myself and Richard and Judy, I think we have a greater understanding of what a wide shot can do from, you know, the feeling of being on stage.
Notes on a Scandal has also earned Dame Judi Dench her 6th Oscar nomination, as well as a 1st Oscar nomination for adapted screenplay for Patrick Marber. It's released next week. Still to come on Film Weekly this week, Christopher Guest, Ricky Gervais and Eugene Levy discuss working on For Your Consideration, and we offer you the chance to win Directed by Douglas Sirk, a splendid box set of the great stylist's films, including stars such as Rock Hudson, Jane Wyman, Lana Turner and Barbara Stanwyck. But first, a rundown of the rest of the week's releases. Bobby is a multi-stranded movie set in LA's Ambassador's Hotel on the day of Robert Kennedy's assassination in 1968. Emilio Estevez makes a tough choice for his first directorial job, trying to keep a dozen storylines going like a Generation Game contestant spinning plates. It is admittedly fun to watch the celebrity cameos. Who's that knocking? Oh, it's Larry Fishburne. And is that Sharon Stone in the beauty salon? And could that be Harry Belafonte having tea with Anthony Hopkins in the lobby? But eventually, you realise that several of the characters have nothing much to do except represent a strand of American society. And then Kennedy is shot. This is a self-important film, directed with too little subtlety and capped by a terrible song by Bryan Adams and performed by Aretha Franklin and Mary J. Blige, who really should know a lot better. The Fountain is a spectacular misfire from Darren Aronofsky, starring his wife Rachel Weisz and the handsome Hugh Jackman. They play a couple across 3 centuries, a queen and a conquistador during the Spanish Inquisition, a dying writer and a surgeon discovering a cure in the modern day, and a time-travelling astronaut thing in the 26th century or whatever. It's never actually quite clear. This is a poorly acted, wretchedly scripted film, lit like a Terry's All Gold commercial. I wanted to hide behind my big winter coat and stuff my woolly gloves into my ears so as not to have to see or hear it, and I shall speak no more on it either. The Lives of the Saints starts well enough with the discovery of an angel off Green Lanes in North London, which gives the local Cypriot and Turkish communities something to squabble over. The film is the debut of photographer Rankin and his co-director Chris Cottam, but they never strike the right tone, working from an old Tony Grissoni script. The film descends into blithering anarchy by the end, with Mark Warren playing a priest dressed as Carmen Miranda. Suburban Mayhem stars Australian Film Institute Actress of the Year Emily Barclay as a teenage slut in a New Zealand community who causes outrage by smoking a lot and driving fast and sleeping with boys. Eventually, she conspires to murder her dad, and the film consists of a half-hearted mockumentary about the killing. It's sloppily made and really rather boring. Them is an effective, if exploitative, chiller about a French couple living in a big Romanian mansion that comes under attack from local hoodies. It's a poor relation to Michael Haneke, but does have some scary moments before I tired of watching a girl running around screaming. It's also got a rather pat and xenophobic payoff, revealing fears of bored East European teenagers. I've a feeling Jade Goody might like it. Awards season is, as you've heard, well and truly upon us, counting down to the BAFTAs on February the 11th and the Oscars on February the 25th. But satirising the whole shebang is For Your Consideration, a film about the shoot of a film called Home for Purim, which finds itself at the centre of internet rumours about Oscar nominations. The film is from Christopher Guest and his team, many of whom have collaborated on films with him in the past, such as Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show and A Mighty Wind. The usual suspects, Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, were there, but this time they were joined by Ricky Gervais. I joined the gang for tea, and amid a free-flowing conversation with Hollywood agents ringing on phones and people nipping off to the toilet, I managed to ask Ricky how he coped with the Jewish element of Los Angeles life.
I didn't know, because it's not like being black. They can hide it. So I was constantly surprised.
Unless you're in the shower.
Yeah. You know what? I honestly never think about it. Yeah. If just think of that a read in print. They can hide it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Don't worry, I'm writing it.
I'm in Mel Gibson's new film.
Jews can hide it. But look, Lenny Bruce said, Italians are happy Jews. Great quote.
But you're, I mean, the actual stuff that you do, that, let's say, the last four or five, the brand that you do, is, I would say, is not a particularly Jewish kind of brand of humour.
No, this was a particular thing. I mean, no. This just happened to be, we thought, this is pretty arcane. Mm. The holiday of Purim is something Eugene or I, we didn't know what it was.
No,
the name, it says Purim Carnival. So we did the research, and we learned about it to the extent that we needed to. We wrote the song together, the Purim song.
That was your song?
Yeah, we wrote the song.
It was a great
And that's that. You know, it's Ricky. You know, you see the work he's done. You say, well, this, we're lucky if he wants to do this, obviously.
Did you ask Ricky?
Of course.
Well, how did that happen? When did you bump into him?
Well, I saw The Office, and I said to my wife, this is the best thing I've seen in, 25 years. This is... too good. It's just too good. Mm-hmm. And she said, you should call him. And I said, that's embarrassing. Again. And then she said, here's the number. I mean, in 10 minutes, she said, I got the number. I called. I found out he was agent. What do you think? And then we did talk on the phone, and we laughed immediately. It was as if we had known each other since we were kids.
Well, he has kind of known you. Well, I mean, anyone in this country has kind of known you.
It's an amazing thing, because when you share a sensibility, when I first met Eugene, even though I'd known his work and he made me laugh, and anyone here... it's such a relief. You just there's no period of kind of, it's just, you start laughing.
Chris is the biggest single influence on everything I've ever done, from Spinal Tap up to yesterday. So it's incredible for me. I mean, you do this for the work, and you say nothing else matters, the money, the reviews, the award, and everything, but the biggest buzz I get is someone like Chris saying he likes my stuff. I went to the school of Christopher Guest and Eugene Levy and Mike McKee. I went to that school. That was 20 years of that.
Well, a lot of people have gone to the school, but no one's graduated.
And I haven't paid my fees yet. I had a loan, so I'm not paying back.
This film,
yeah, so. I sort of knew what to do, but there is something in me that I think, I want him to go, that is brilliant. That's the best bit of improv I've ever done in my life. I'm not doing this anymore.
Somewhere amidst all that cacophony were Ricky Gervais, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, myself and Christopher Guest, all battling for attention ahead of the release of For Your Consideration on February the 9th. It's competition time! Last week, we offered you three copies of the first Rocky film, available now on Definitive Edition DVD. We wanted you to give us the connection between Rocky and Marie Antoinette. Well, the three lucky winners include Andy Essex, Neil Casey from Athlone, the heart of Ireland there, and this from Gavin Murphy in Aberystwyth, Wales, who says, how's about this for a connection? Rocky's wife, Adrian, is played by Talia Shire, who is the aunt of Sofia Coppola, who directed Marie Antoinette. Nice and simple. But he says there is a different way round. Rocky's wife, Adrian, is played by Talia Shire, whose son, Jason Schwartzman, played the role of Louis XVI in Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. Nice connections there, Gavin from Aberystwyth, Neil in Ireland, and Andy Essex. Your copies of Rocky are on their way, accompanied by a mangy old dog. This week, the prize is just one box set of Douglas Sirk movies, the originator of the chick flick, the ultimate weepy exponent. This is worth about £70, so you'll have to work for it to get films such as Has Anyone Seen My Gal?, All I Desire, starring Barbara Stanwyck, Magnificent Obsession, starring Jane Wyman and Rock Hudson. Then there's Written on the Wind, which stars Rock Hudson and Lauren Bacall and Robert Stack and Dorothy Malone. And then there's the ultimate weepy of all time, Imitation of Life, starring Lana Turner and John Gavin. Seven films in this box set. Magnificent thing it is. As I said, it's worth £70, so you're going to have to work for it. What we want you to do is name two recent films clearly influenced by the work of Douglas Sirk, both starring the same actress. What we want you to do is name both the films, both the directors, and the one actress. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk. That's podcasts@observer.co.uk, and we'll read the winners out next week. Well, that's it for this edition of Film Weekly. Next week, I'll be talking to Brian Cox about his new film, Running with Scissors, opposite Annette Bening, and how he copes with the ghost of Hannibal Lecter. We wish you happy viewing. Until then, thank you for listening. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly is produced by Paul Noble.